And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour, Malcolm Nance, counterterrorism and intelligence advisor for the U.S. government's special operations, Homeland Security and intelligence agencies. He's been deployed on numerous clandestine operations in the Balkans, in the Middle East, also sub-Saharan Africa. He's a decorated veteran and a former Navy intelligence officer. 30 years of experience in field and combat intelligence activity, including as an Arabic-speaking field interrogator, the author of numerous books, including Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe, also The Terrorist Recognition Handbook, a practitioner's manual on predicting and identifying terrorist activity, and his latest book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Malcolm Nance will provide analysis of ISIS in a presentation this evening titled The Dynamics of ISIS, Its Origins and Implications for the United States. It's at 7 p.m. at Iowa State University's Great Hall in the Memorial Union. It's a presentation that is free and open to the public. Malcolm Nance is in our AIM studio. Welcome to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about, before we get to WikiLeaks, the topic of your latest book, let's talk about ISIS. Today, the Iraqi government forces have launched a U.S.-backed offensive to drive the Islamic State from Mosul, the northern city, a battle to retake this last major stronghold in the country held by the militants. How do you size up the battle for the city? It's a city of over a million people now that it's started.
Well, it's going to be a very intensive and deep battle, principally because ISIS has had spent months now fortifying the city, putting in various rings of defensive positions, channelizing the places where these offensives can come from. But to the effect of what happened just in the last 24 hours, numerous villages leading up to the outskirts of Mosul have been taken by Kurdish forces, Peshmerga forces, and the Iraqi army coming from the south. So for the most part, leading up to the, you know, right up to the gates of Mosul, maybe a little less difficult than it had had been anticipated. But we've also seen ISIS apply the tactics that we had seen them apply in Fallujah and Ramadi, and the battles for Tikrit, which is large-scale suicide bomber attacks, just dozens of trucks coming up and attempting to explode in the middle of it offensive forces. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be an intensive fight, but we'll have to see what they how ISIS really wants to hold that
lasting
city.
Days, weeks, months. What is your estimate?
You know, every battle is different, and you know, Fallujah was a very deliberate battle where we went in and went, you know, meter by meter slowly because we found thousands of improvised explosive devices around the city. Ramadi was the same way, but there were some very intense clashes at strategic points, and it tended to fall a little faster. Mosul is the second largest city in Iraq. It essentially is a captive city. It's the largest density of ISIS combat forces is on the axis between Mosul and the city to the west, Tal Afar. And it's a question of whether ISIS is really going to put up a fight, or are they just going to do a defensive battle and try to fall back to their central caliphate.
Mm-hmm. The U.S.-led air campaign has helped drive the Islamic State from much of the territory that it held. This largest concentration of fighters, what I've read, 4,000, maybe 8,000 fighters thought to remain in Mosul. I'm wondering, in the bigger picture, Malcolm Nance, what turned the tide after it seemed that that ISIS was unstoppable, after they captured so much territory and Iraqi forces seemed unable to stop them?
You know, in fact, ISIS has defeated ISIS. And when I say that, I mean in the sense that ISIS, when it took over Mosul and actually did its operations to seize western Iraq and Fallujah, Ramadi in early 2014, and then culminated with their seizure of Mosul and drive down onto Baghdad in mid-2014, they managed to actually weed out from the Iraqi forces all of the officers and men who had no capacity, who had no ability to actually fight them, who fled the battlefield. And that resulted in some horrific massacres. Then ISIS's establishment of its own caliphate, its administrative structure, and then meting out harsh punishments, slavery, abuse, including authorized pedophilia, and just horrific mass murder, galvanized virtually every force in the central Middle East. We're talking the Peshmerga, the Kurds, the U.S.-backed Kurds from northern Iraq, the Iraqi Shia, the Iraqi Sunnah, the Iraqi Christians, the Syrian Kurds, the Syrian army, and Turkey, as well as given operational support from the United States and our allies. Everyone is against ISIS right now, and they have brought this on themselves. And we will probably see the end of the caliphate here in the next 6 months to a year.
So at what point can we say we've achieved victory over ISIS, over this declared caliphate? Is there some major thing that would signal that?
Well, when the city of Raqqa, which is in eastern Syria, just west of the Iraqi border, when we take Mosul, and Mosul may be a matter of months, actually clearing that city, depending on whether ISIS wants to really fight for it or fall back. And try to create a bastion inside of Raqqa itself. Then you'll see that city surrounded, and there'll be their Okinawa moment where, everyone will be a suicide bomber. And when that city is taken either by Turkish-backed forces, the Free Syrian Army forces, or even Iraqi forces, which eventually could drive across the Iraqi border and help surround that city, then you'll see the end of the physical caliphate that was established in 2014.
Mm-hmm. What allowed ISIS to form and thrive for so long? And connected to that, how much blame do you feel Western powers, and specifically the Obama administration, should bear?
Well, I mean, ISIS wouldn't have existed at all if we hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003. That's just, now I'm stating that as what we call in the intelligence community, an intelligence fact. It was a political decision taken by the leadership of the United States. We thought that we would be able to go and re-engineer the Middle East. People who were actual specialists within State Department and the intelligence community weren't consulted about this. And when we invaded Iraq, we unleashed forces that had been held down for, almost half a century. We had a Sunni minority that was dominating a Shia majority in that country and lived a rather luxurious life. And when that was taken away from them, they became terrorist insurgents, and they allowed al-Qaeda to enter Iraq in 2003. And, ISIS itself started in 2006 as a group. Al-Qaeda in Iraq transitioned its name and became the Islamic State of Iraq. And to tell you the truth, AQI, al-Qaeda in Iraq, and ISI were waning by the time 2008, 2009 came around. We had great pressure on them. But it was the decisions of the Iraqi government that actually allowed them to expand and explode. I mean, we had essentially co-opted the Iraqi insurgents, certainly the ex-Ba'athist insurgents, with our Anbar Awakening, which was a process that allowed them to come back into government. And then the government of Nouri al-Maliki just decided that they were having none of that. They took away all of their autonomy, took away their ability to make money for their families, to benefit from revenues in the oil field, excluded them from government. And the only people that were hiring was al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they became the Islamic State of Iraq and exploded onto the scene. It's the same insurgent group we had been fighting from 2003. It's just that they had all combined forces at this point and became a force.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour is Malcolm Nancy, speaking tonight at Iowa State University, and he's a counterterrorism and intelligence advisor for U.S. government's Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies. Wanted to speak a few minutes to the topic of your latest book, The Plot to Hack America, its title, How Putin Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. This weekend, WikiLeaks released another cache of emails allegedly linking the Hillary Clinton campaign, Chairman John Podesta, bringing the total to more than 11,000 emails over the last 8 days. The Clinton campaign has not confirmed that the hacked emails are real. NPR has not been able to confirm their authenticity, but the campaign has linked the hack to Russia and says Moscow is interfering with the election to promote Donald Trump's candidacy. Do you agree with U.S. intelligence that the Russians are behind these latest WikiLeaks hacks?
Yes, I agree 100%. As a matter of fact, this book went to print on September 1st, and everything that I wrote in there, which was an analysis of how Russia would have conducted these hacks, the type of intelligence processes they would have put into place in order to get their preferred candidate elected, in order to meet goals for Russia, not for the United States. The first thing that's most important for people who are listening to this to understand is that the United States was attacked by elements of Russian intelligence at the direction of the president of Russia, who was the former director of the KGB. And okay. They did this in order to facilitate Russia's own strategic goals of disbanding NATO, breaking up the European Union, and allowing Russia to have free reign in Eastern Europe.
Okay. Let me react to a bit of audio. I'm sure you're very familiar with it. Donald Trump's assertion from the very first presidential debate, which happened after the publishing of this book, and after you maintain all, it was very clear that the Russians were behind this latest these latest hacks. I'd like you to react to it, but this is a memorable quote of Donald Trump from the very very first debate.
Look at the mess that we're in. As far as the cyber, I agree to parts of what Secretary Clinton said. We should be better than anybody else, and perhaps we're not. I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC. She's saying Russia, 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 but I don't, maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay? You don't know who broke in to DNC.
Okay, Malcolm Lance, do we not know? Did we not know at the time Donald Trump said that?
We absolutely do know. He was briefed during one of his intelligence briefings that it was Russia. This last week, the president of the United States came out and made a public statement with the director of national intelligence, which means he has consensus of the entirety of all U.S. intelligence agencies, plus the director of Homeland Security, that the United States has high confidence. That is 90% or greater confidence that they have the evidence that Russian intelligence from the Russian State Security Committee, the FSB, formerly known as the KGB, and Russian military intelligence, the GRU, using Russia's version of their national security agency, known as the Special Communications Information Service, had hacked into these servers, left their fingerprints on these hacks. We had seen these fingerprints before when they hacked power plants in the state of the and the nation of Ukraine, when they hacked the state of Georgia and took down its national internet infrastructure, the state of Estonia, west to the German parliament, and other nations, including the Department of Defense hacks. They have very specific fingerprints. They use tools of, you know, if you don't have $1 billion, you are not going to be developing the types of tools that they use to conduct these hacks. And they sat in the DNC and the DCCC servers for over a year, stole every aspect of their operations, and selectively released them to WikiLeaks, using WikiLeaks as sort of their laundromat. Mm-hmm. This is now certified by the entirety of the U.S. intelligence community. Like I said, high confidence is 90%. We put Hellfire missiles and cruise missiles into terrorists at 75% confidence. So the president has made it very clear this is a hostile intelligence agency's attack on the electoral process of the United States.
I'm not sure if this is your area of expertise, but given that Donald Trump was briefed on this and what you say is seems to be very convincing, the entire intelligence community here in the United States very sure that the Russians are behind this, why would he continue to question the source of the leaks?
Well, I write quite a bit about this in my book. Donald Trump was characterized by Mike Morrell, the acting director of Central Intelligence Agency and former deputy director of Central Intelligence Agency, as an unwitting agent of Russia. And that is incorrect. An agent is a technical term of art for someone who is going to carry out acts that are known, and he does it either for pay or ideology. I believe that Donald Trump, since 2011, when he went to Miss Universe in Russia, in meeting the oligarchs of Russia, all of whom are under the control of the autocrat Vladimir Putin, just adopted their ideology. He saw that as the ideology of people who were making hundreds of billions of dollars, and he wanted to work within that world. But within the intelligence community, we call this putting on invisible strings. And I think that he's become not an unwitting agent, but an unwitting asset. Whereas he believes in what people told him in Russia. He believes that NATO is obsolete, which is insane because the United States has had stability in Europe, with exception of the Balkans, because of the responsibility of NATO since it was informed after World War II. The only time NATO has ever collectively come to the defense of a member of NATO when they invoked Article 5 on September 12, 2001, and collectively stated that when the United States was attacked on 9/11, All of NATO was attacked, and they supported us in Afghanistan with blood and treasure for 10 years. To suddenly say out of nowhere that that is worthless, obsolete because one or two nations aren't paying their fair share of it, is to give complete reign of Europe over to Vladimir Putin and Russia. And that has never been rational U.S. policy, and it has that ideology has to come from somewhere. And maybe there will be an investigation to find out precisely where he gained his ideology.
News reports in the past few days that the CIA is developing scenarios for an electronic attack on Russian leadership, I guess, a response to this Russian hacking. According to sources, including current government officials, the intent here is to embarrass top Russian officials through clandestine and widespread hacking. So a counter-strike, a counter-cyber strike. First of all, why announce an attack beforehand? And how much capacity does the U.S. have to do damage and strike back at the Russians?
Well, first, there are a myriad of reasons of why we could have released that information. The first one is to make sure that it is eminently clear to our opponents in Russia that the United States takes that this hacking seriously. We take it as an attack. And it was. This is the first time in 240 years the electoral process of the United States has been called into question. I mean, this is worse than the election of 1860, which, you know, was part of the Civil War. We have never had a hostile government or a hostile intelligence agency put their thumb on the scales of our electorate in such a manner as we've seen this year. And it's nonpartisan. It has nothing to do with Republican or Democrat. This is a foreign nation attempting to hijack our system, and we may not have seen what might be coming down the pike on election day. So for the president to put that out publicly will give Russia pause. Number two, we may want to see what their defensive processes are when they understand that they may be under attack, and we may be sending small, low-level probing attacks out there. We don't know specifically what's going to be done. And finally, it's in our interest to make sure that our enemy understands that we have capacities that they haven't seen. We don't use cyber attack the way Russia does. They use it on a daily basis. They use it virtually all around the world. They use it to steal money. They use it to intimidate their foes and to further the goals of the Kremlin. We don't do that. When we launch a cyber attack, it's very specific. It's usually tailored. And we are worlds ahead of them at the National Security Agency and Cyber Command. And it may not even affect Russia directly proper. It may be that we're going after their mafia money in Honduras. Don't know.
Well, what would that look like, an all-out cyber war between Russia and the U.S.? Would we, as regular people, notice this? Would power go out in cities? Would there be attacks, counterattacks like that, instead of missiles and bombs coming down?
Well, cyber weapons are just, and that's how you need to understand these things. This isn't just hacking and going into somebody's email. This is where we have the process to take control of systems. In a cyber war, what you're talking about here is an extension of physical warfare. If you go in and let's say Russia doesn't like what we do. Let's say we steal all of their oligarchs' illicit funds that are hidden away in banks in Cyprus, for example, and we take $100 billion away from them and, their criminal proceeds are gone. If they were to launch an actual cyber attack, they could shut down the power on the eastern seaboard of the United States.
They're capable of that now.
That capability exists with many nations. And it's because the United States does not have an integrated cyber defense and it is not a dictatorship. We leave the public-private partnerships to go and set up their own internal defenses. We have a national defense against our Department of Defense and our government, which is responsible by the Central Security Service of NSA. But the civilian world itself is relatively on its own. But we would certainly be able to help recover from that. And then at that point, it could be tit for tat. And that is not what we want to move on to because, you know, once you've launched a cyber weapon, if you shut down power in New York City, you are going to kill people. People will die when respirators go off and child life support goes off and people fall down stairwells. The next step is warfare, and we don't want to move to that point. But we certainly want to make it clear that, you know, playing with the American electoral process will have some sort of consequence.
What do you think will be the aftermath of this election, considering, claims that the electoral system is rigged, and also with these hacks coming here, with the WikiLeaks hacks, the work between WikiLeaks, as you maintain, between WikiLeaks and doing the bidding of Russia?
Well, you know, if you were actually read most of the emails that are coming from WikiLeaks, they're actually benign. They just show that there's, you know, there's political operation going on. It's the black propaganda. It's where that people can actually put in one email with one word or a sentence change to make it appear nefarious. And that's why once the DNC servers were hacked, you can't believe anything that comes through that stream of data. But on the other hand, it could be very bad on election day if Russia decides to play at a much higher level of hardball. Based on the things that we've heard from Donald Trump, he believes that Pennsylvania, for example, is a state that he should win, but he's 11 points behind in the polls. But if Russian intelligence won't hack the machines themselves, even though they've probed 25 states in the United States and have penetrated 3 voter registration databases, the easiest place to create mayhem is to go to the voter tallies on election night and just change them. Change them publicly, you know, shift 10 million votes from one column to another for 5 minutes so the entire world sees it, and it would throw the United States into near civil war.
Malcolm Nance, I wish we had more time. Fascinating what you have brought to light here. Thank you. And tonight, Malcolm Nance will be speaking at Iowa State University at the Memorial Union in the Great Hall. The presentation is free and open to the public. Start time is 7 p.m. Malcolm Nance, enjoy your time in Iowa.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, with help from Sean McClain today, Phil Moss, and John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.